compared to the indignities heaped upon her by editors over the next few decades. Soon after becoming a farm team member of the Avengers, she was impregnated by one cosmic supervillain so that she might bear his child. She did, and it turned out to be the supervillain himself. Don't ask. Her fellow Avengers, which included another superheroine, the Wasp, barely acknowledged that Ms. Marvel had essentially been raped. Furious at their dismissive attitude, she joined the X-Men for a while, only to be transformed into an alien energy force humanoid called Binary. That didn't do much for fans, so she was given back her normal human form and renamed Warbird, along with a diminution in her superpowers. As Warbird, she rejoined the Avengers as a reliable Rock'em Sock'em teammate, only to develop a drinking problem as a result of feelings of inadequacy. Warbird's subsequent negligence and sloppiness in the field of battle forced Captain America to move toward court-martialing her. She quit the Avengers instead. If Ms. Marvel's travails seemed unduly harsh, and her treatment at the hands of male writers, artists, and editors seemed unnecessarily misogynistic, she wasn't alone. By 1999, the plight of superheroines in general was finally acknowledged by a fan named Gail Simone, who posted a blog entitled Women in Refrigerators. The name referred to a much-decried Green Lantern story from 1994, where the current iteration of the Emerald Ring-wielding hero came home to find his girlfriend dead, mutilated, dismembered, and crammed into a refrigerator by his current arch-nemesis. Simone simply tallied up all the superheroines and girlfriends of superheroes who had been killed, maimed, or depowered in comic books. The list was long, and taken as a whole, a condemnation of the male-dominated industry. Next to Ms. Marvel's name and list of depredations foisted upon her, Simone simply commented, "Sheesh," employing one of Stan Lee's favorite expressions of chagrin. The happy ending to the refrigerator story is that Simone was eventually hired as a comic book writer, first by Marvel Comics and eventually with a long-term contract at DC Comics. In 2003, she took on the only really major all-female superhero group, Birds of Prey, a snappy, aggressive team fronted by Oracle, the former Batgirl who had been rendered paraplegic by the Joker, now one of comics' most assertive and brilliant characters. Simone also became the longest-running female writer ever to render The Adventures of Wonder Woman, beginning in 2007. Her point of view about superheroines and refrigerators was simple. If you demolish most of the characters that girls like, the girls won't read comics. That's it. Still, female characters continued to be demolished. In one outrageous sequence, during the 2004 Identity Crisis series, the wife of DC's elongated man hero, Sue Dibny, was raped by a second-rate villain in the Justice League's headquarters and subsequently murdered. It was paradoxical that such refrigerator moments occurred at DC in the 1990s into the 21st century, as the company had been led by a woman since 1976. Jeanette Kahn was a publishing wunderkind in her 20s, energizing a host of teenager magazines when Warner Communications brought her on board to revitalize its superhero publications and the way they met the public. She became president of DC Comics in 1981 and steered the company through several successes, not the least of which was pioneering relationships with creators that gave them unprecedented royalties and participation. Before Kahn stepped down in 2002, she promoted Karen Berger to become editor of DC's groundbreaking Vertigo line in 1993. Berger was generally regarded to be one of the industry's most sensitive and courageous editors. She served out her tenure until 2013. One of Kahn's greatest achievements, by her own reckoning, is that, quote, "When I came to DC Comics, we were 35 people on staff, two of whom were women, one secretary, and one in production. By the time I left DC, we were 250 people, of which half were women. As women got more involved in the workplace, and as creators of comic book stories, the things that perhaps were directed solely to a young male reader began to be directed also to young women as well. Kahn still realizes that comic book superheroes have traditionally had the imprimatur of a male fantasy audience and male fantasy creators. I always said that the male artists drew the men they wanted to be like and the women they wanted to be with, which is why they often had pneumatic breasts. Whether or not female superheroes will ever really share the dais with the male superheroes at the Comic Book Hall of Fame awards dinner remains to be seen. But for what it's worth, poor Ms. Marvel's career appears to be on an upswing. Thanks to the sponsorship of Iron Man, himself a recovering alcoholic, Carol Danvers got herself straightened out, rejoined the ranks of the Avengers, and reclaimed the name of Ms. Marvel. After proving her worth to Captain America one more time, tough taskmaster, that Cap, he encouraged her to assume the mantle of the great Kree warrior who had been killed off a few years before. So, in 2012, Carol Danvers was given her own Captain Marvel book, complete with a smashing new uniform, a great haircut, and a female writer, Kelly Sue DeConnick. The use of Ms. made her feel like an auxiliary character, said DeConnick, who insisted on the name change. She got her powers from Captain Marvel, and he's gone. If somebody is going to pick up that mantle, it's Carol. She knew him, she respected him, she shares his DNA, she's earned it. The new comic was subtitled Earth's Mightiest Mortal, in a wink to the original Captain Marvel from way back when. It was about time. Chapter 7. Heroes We Can Believe In Again. Champions of the New Millennium. Stand Tall. 9/11 and Superheroes. The grim notion of Manhattan meeting an apocalyptic fate occurred in comic books as early as the fall of 1941, when, in retaliation against the detested surface dwellers, Namor the Submariner terrorized the city by unleashing a tidal wave of deadly force. But, as comics historian Bradford Wright put it, on September 11, 2001, the meaning of "look up in the sky" changed forever in New York City. Changed horribly. Any kid who had grown up reading comic books had seen buildings in New York destroyed over and over again in many ways, but none of that could prepare people for the reality. That morning, Marvel Comics editor-in-chief, Joe Quesada, ran to the company's offices on Fifth Avenue to check on his staff. Amidst the terrible tragedy of that day, Quesada realized, quote, "It was very clear to me, and to all of us at Marvel, that it was something that we were going to have to address in our books. It would be callous for us not to. We were a company, a universe, that had Spider-Man swing across those towers. We're a company that had its characters fighting World War II. We're a company that had its characters experience the civil rights movement, and all those things." Quesada turned to J. Michael Straczynski, an accomplished producer and screenwriter, television's Babylon 5, whom he had just lured from his Hollywood career to take over as lead writer on The Amazing Spider-Man. Straczynski was working on location in Vancouver when Quesada asked him to consider a response to 9/11, perhaps through the perspective of Peter Parker, who was not only the torchbearer of the Marvel label, but comics' most representative New Yorker. Straczynski told Quesada, "I don't know how to do that. I'm sure the words are in the dictionary somewhere. But which ones, and what order to put them in, I have no freaking idea." Upon reflection, he reconsidered. In this very strange prose poem meditation on the events of 9/11, in a voice and a style that I had never written in before, the story kind of found me. I wrote the entire thing in like 45 minutes, just in one sitting. The Amazing Spider-Man number 36 hit the stands relatively quickly, on November 15th, barely 2 months after the events in Lower Manhattan. The artist was John Romita, Jr., one of Marvel's admired superstars and the son of the artist who had done so much to elevate Spider-Man to iconic status in the late 1960s. The cover was entirely black, except for a white knockout of the magazine's logo. The story's 22 pages were plotless, but hardly without incident, as Spider-Man surveys the scene of the tragedy in mute bewilderment. Some things are beyond words, beyond comprehension, beyond forgiveness, went the omniscient narration. I wanted it to be more of a questioning, said Straczynski, and I think by doing that, it became more long-lasting and enduring than if I just said, we're going to go get them and march off into the horizon. Spider-Man runs into a dust-covered couple, escaping from the debris. Where were you? How could you let this happen? They ask, voicing the question raised that day by people who have faith in superheroes. The wall crawler turns away, nearly mute in his impotence, much like DC's Green Lantern, who in 1970 turned away from the elderly black man who asked a similarly rhetorical question about the efficacy of super beings. Later in the story, Spider-Man stands shoulder to shoulder with the real-life first responders, firemen, EMS workers, and policemen in the debris of the World Trade Center, although Straczynski and Romita make clear that the real heroes were the real heroes. But with our costumes and our superpowers, we are writ small by the true heroes. Spider-Man sees Captain America standing by Ground Zero, but doesn't approach him. He's the only one who could know, because he's been here before. I wish I had not lived to see this once. I can't imagine what it is to see this twice. Straczynski explained that, quote, because Peter Parker is a native New Yorker, I thought that his reaction would be more of a personal reaction. I didn't want to get into policies or politics or the way we might respond to this. Captain America, on the other hand, represented the larger issues at stake. I didn't want to delve too deeply in it, which is why Cap doesn't speak in the course of the book. Whereas Peter represents the people, Cap's a symbol of the country. The creative team took some heat for a page where Marvel's most nefarious malefactors, Dr. Doom, Magneto, the Kingpin, villains who had wanted to destroy Manhattan dozens of times among them, stand amongst the rubble in contemplative silence. Dr. Doom is even glanced with a tear streaming down between his scarred face and his fiercely armored mask. It was not Doc Doom and other villains at Ground Zero, just like it was not a young child crying for his fallen father, said Romita. It was a representation, a symbol, a metaphor for real feelings and thoughts. To get this point across to those who don't watch Dan Rather, it was effective. When the events of 9/11 fell upon the Earth, Frank Miller was in the middle of writing and drawing a sequel to Batman The Dark Knight Returns called The Dark Knight Strikes Again. He had just completed a sequence where a plane crashes into a Metropolis skyscraper and didn't know what to do with it. It was very strange, he said, to wake up in the morning and realize for the first time in my career that I didn't know what my next book was going to be, because all the plans I had seemed, well, not just trivial, but irrelevant. Because these fantasies don't exist in their own little dimension. Everything is a metaphor for something that's real. This is how pop culture works. We process things and then turn them into a product that is at once more palatable, but deeply resonant. The comic book community processed the event quickly, releasing several compilations of short meditations on 9/11, including Marvel's Heroes and DC's 9/11, The World's Finest Comic Book Artists and Writers Tell Stories to Remember. The vignettes varied from human interest stories to superheroic meditations on retribution. Proceeds from the books went to 9/11-oriented charities. But the Spider-Man issue had the most profound effect on readers. It was a bestseller, and it was written about in the press nationwide. I've heard from firemen who were there, from police officers, from reverends who used it in sermons, teachers who used it in the classroom, because kids don't watch Nightline, They had no way to put it in context, said Straczynski, and it allowed them to talk about it in a different way. Joe Quesada said, We released the book really not caring what anybody was going to think about it, but just knowing that it was something that we had to do, and it was cathartic for us as well. The more general effect of 9/11 on the world of superheroes is harder to quantify. Perhaps the tragedy had the inadvertent consequence of steering comic book storylines out of the grim and gritty era. Suddenly, heroism was nothing to be ashamed of, and heroic motivations no longer needed to be imputed or psychoanalyzed into irrelevance. Certainly, there was a strange inversion of fiction and reality. The tragedy of the real events of 9/11 had only been seen before in fiction, and the power of that tragic reality had been thrust onto the broad shoulders of fictional superheroes. Nowhere was the transformative shock of reality more apparent than in the Marvel comic series Civil War. Only 45 days after the terrorist attacks on U.S. soil, the Patriot Act was overwhelmingly, if hastily, endorsed by Congress and signed into law by President George W. Bush. The Uniting and Strengthening America by Providing Appropriate Tools Required to Intercept and Obstruct Terrorism Act of 2001 sounded like something out of a contrived Stanley acronym. Something like the Supreme Headquarters International Espionage Law Enforcement Division, which was the original name for SHIELD, Marvel's resident super spy organization headed by the grizzled Nick Fury. Except the USA Patriot Act was a very real, very insidious, and very controversial piece of legislation. Intended to combat domestic terrorism by enhancing domestic security, the Patriot Act enabled law enforcement to broaden surveillance procedures, overstep previous restrictions in search and seizure, and widen access to personal records and information, all in the service of allowing the government more influence in the comings and goings of its citizens. Civil libertarians were alarmed and outraged. More conservative denizens were relieved and supportive. For many, it was a struggle over the boundaries of law and order. Since superheroes are in the law and order business, it was perhaps inevitable that the Patriot Act would make it into a 21st century comic book. Multiple issue crossover series have become increasingly prevalent in the industry. Since Crisis on Infinite Earths, some sort of special event from both DC and Marvel, where the superstars of the respective lines would be drawn together under some contrived pretext for a multi-character slugfest of apocalyptic proportions, would appear nearly every summer. Around 2005, Marvel's editors were planning their next iteration of an annual crossover event, perhaps an epic, where that selfsame SHIELD might use its law enforcement skills to track down the Avengers on behalf of the U.S. government. According to writer and editor Jeff Loeb, Scottish-born writer Mark Miller was concurrently drawn into the multi-part PBS documentary about the Civil War, directed by Ken Burns. Mark was fascinated by the brother versus brother dynamic, that your house could be divided purely by ideology. The house divided against itself would be the Marvel House of Ideas. The ideological wedge would be the registration of super beings with the government. The crossover event became the 7-issue Civil War series, which would become the nexus for a score of related spin-off stories in other books. The promotional tagline, echoing the mantra of the American labor movement, was, Whose side are you on? The sides became clearly demarcated in the first issue of Civil War, which hit stands in late spring 2006. A fatal cataclysm, brought on by a group of inexperienced and irresponsible superheroes, inflames citizens across the country. If superhumans have such extreme and lethal powers, shouldn't they be registered with the government? As Miller put it, the civil war between the heroes is over the Superhuman Registration Act, which mandates that anyone who puts on a costume and goes out to try to enforce the law must register with and become an agent of the federal government. It's an ideological split down the middle. On one side of the divide was Captain America, who typically would side with the federal government, but rejects the notion that heroes should surrender their liberties to a McCarthy-esque decree. He winds up going underground and recruiting a corps of super-rebels, such as Daredevil and Luke Cage. In his words, "Masked heroes have been part of this country for as long as anyone can remember. You're asking me to arrest people who risk their lives for this country every day of the week. I think this plan will split us down the middle. I think you're going to have us at war with each other." On the side of government security is Iron Man, who, in his alter ego as billionaire inventor Tony Stark, appreciates the functional machinery of a well-ordered state. He drafts in the scientific and technical skills of Mr. Fantastic, along with the more conservative forces of the Marvel Universe, in the hopes of creating a viable system for registering superheroes and incarcerating reprobates. As Iron Man says, "We're superheroes. We tackle supercrime, and we save people's lives. The only thing changing is that the kids, the amateurs, and the sociopaths are getting weeded out." Writer Mark Miller didn't take sides. He preferred to set up his opposing players and get out of the way. "I think you don't want to think of your superheroes as being liberal or conservative. I think those guys should be above that." But Civil War wasn't a treatise about civil discourse. At the end of the day, it was a rollicking slugfest, with Iron Man and Captain America having at each other on a battleground while the other major players in the Marvel Universe were drawn into the fray. Still, it was a character-oriented saga that raised many questions about the ethos of the superhero. Why do they keep their identities secret? On whose behalf are they fighting their battles? And finally, who asked them to show up in the first place? Miller and his artist Steve McNiven threaded those questions through the Marvel Universe. Spider-Man started on Iron Man's side and revealed his secret identity as Peter Parker at a standing-room-only news conference, giving editor J. Jonah Jameson a coronary, then switched to Captain America's camp when he thought Iron Man was in over his shelled head. The Fantastic Four were split down the middle. As non-citizens, the Black Panther and Namor the Submariner initially sat out the conflict. The mystic Doctor Strange went on a hunger strike. As Grant Morrison put it,
"It starts with Captain America on the right and Iron Man's on the left and ends the confrontation. They've swapped places and now Iron Man's become this representative of the establishment and Captain America represents old America, this kind of outlaw liberal America refusing to bow down to the powers of the state." And it was really interesting. It was very simple, like a cartoon, but I think that's why it worked. And as I say, it was about questions we were actually asking ourselves in the real world. And that's when I think comics are at their best, when they're actually involved in the discourse like that. And to do it in the form of a Marvel comic, where it's just, this is how you solve problems in comics. Here's one guy representing this, and here's one guy representing that, and we'll let them fight each other and see who wins. And it's a very simple way to dramatize an argument, but it works really well in comics.
By the end of the saga, Captain America would surrender to the government as his alter ego, Steve Rogers, which would lead to another huge multi-story epic where he would be assassinated, and Tony Stark would become director of S.H.I.E.L.D., where he promised to safeguard his allies' secret identities. The mother of an innocent bystander killed in the epic's first issue gave her blessing to Stark, and in so doing may have delivered the epitaph of the grim and gritty era. "I truly believe you've given people heroes we can believe in again." If the events of 9/11 foreshadowed a change in direction for superhero comic books, Civil War pointed the way. When you work on a television show, it's going to be on a year from now. If you make a movie, it's going to be out in a theater 2 years from now, said Jeff Loeb. In comics, on the other hand, you start, and 3 to 6 months later, you're still in the middle of the discourse. Civil War was an opportunity to be able to comment on what was going on in our society in a very real-world way with larger-than-life characters. As if to underline the profundity of Loeb's comment, it's worth recalling that the instigating incident of Civil War was the explosive destruction of an elementary school, instigated by the foolish move of an errant superhero, which resulted in the death of innocent children. For the comic book series, that school was set in Stamford, Connecticut. Coincidentally, 41 miles from Newtown, Connecticut, and Sandy Hook Elementary School. The third generation, the retro artists. As comic book readers grew older, it was no surprise that they wanted to reach back to the comics from their childhood, a kind of serial comfort food. As the 20th century evolved into the 21st, there were many attempts at capturing the nostalgia for the late 1950s and 60s. Nostalgia comes in many colors, and no two artists could be more different from each other than Alex Ross and Darwin Cook. Yet no two artists displayed as much affection for and attention toward the superheroes of their childhood. Together, as the alpha and omega of comic book illustration, they define their own status by redefining an earlier era. Over the course of a decade, Ross and Cook re-examined the superheroes of the late 1950s and early 60s from two completely complementary prisms and created two respective seminal comic book miniseries. Marvel's, 1994, a four-issue series written by Kurt Busiek and painted and illustrated by Ross, and The New Frontier, 2004, written and illustrated by Cook for DC Comics. Ross desperately wanted to paint the superheroes he loved as a kid, so he enrolled at an art academy at the age of 16, specializing in drafting and painting. There, he fell under the thrall of two classic American illustrators, Norman Rockwell and J.C. Leyendecker. By studying these two legends, Ross learned the techniques to render his beloved superheroes. He finally got the chance to put his talents to work when Kurt Busiek revisited the early days of the Marvel Universe through, literally, the lens of Phil Sheldon, a photographer for the Daily Bugle who follows the escapades of super beings, Marvels, as he calls them, from the emergence of the Human Torch through the death of Gwen Stacy. No one had ever seen anything like Ross's hyper-realistic painting style. He often modeled his renditions on live models, action figures, and friends and neighbors. Marvels debuted before the widescreen adventures of most of Marvel's superheroes, so to see Spider-Man or the X-Men in full realistic color was a breathtaking experience. The book made Ross's reputation, and he remains one of comicdom's most venerated and prolific cover and poster artists. Darwin Cook had been enthralled with Batman as a small child. When his mother forgot to call him in from playing in his Buffalo backyard one Thursday at 7:30, and he missed the second installment of a Batman episode, he stopped speaking to her for months. Cook entered the comics field through the world of animation, serving as a major storyboard artist on Bruce Timm's Batman the Animated Series. In 2004, he took on the epic story of the showcase years of the Silver Age at DC, introducing DC's new heroes in the order of when they were released, Martian Manhunter, The Flash, Green Lantern, and so on, as the New Frontier. Cook's artistry called up the simple but powerful graphic pleasures of the Max Fleischer Superman cartoons and Jack Kirby's early 1960s explosive panels. Borrowing from John Kennedy's vision of America's future, Cook referred to the 380 pages of The New Frontier as a, quote, period piece with epic overtones and strong heroes. One More Day. Retcons and Reboots. Many of the perceived outrages in contemporary popular culture, censorship, pandering to a youth market, making movies out of inferior material, what have you, have existed for decades. 21st century culture does not have the monopoly on screwing things up. Retconning, changing the continuity of a comic book's character retroactively, and rebooting, reworking a character from scratch, or nearly from scratch, have become the twin necessary evils of the contemporary comic book world. Publishers and editors, eager to attract new readers and to inspire their current stable of writers and artists, have handed over the keys to their most valuable vehicles on frequent occasions, allowing for a plethora of variant storylines and a concordance of tweaks and changes that nearly defy coherence or clarification. Many fans, especially the newer ones, jump on board. Older fans often throw up their hands or throw away their collections. If the reappearance of Captain America in Avengers No. 4 in 1964 was comic book's first major retcon, it could be argued that the first major reboot was during the emergence of the Silver Age. What, really, was the transformation of the Golden Age Flash into the Scarlet Speedster of 1956 other than a reboot? Granted, these were two different Flashes, but it was still a successful reinvention of the franchise. Throughout the 1960s at Marvel Comics, the character of inventor Henry Hank Pym ran through a walk-in-sized closet full of superhero suits during the first 6 years of his existence, starting out as Ant-Man, then Giant-Man, then Goliath, and finally, but not ultimately, as Yellowjacket. Perhaps the first prominent reboot came in 1968 in the pages of Wonder Woman No. 178. Writer Denny O'Neill decided to climb on the feminist bandwagon and have Wonder Woman renounce her Amazon identity and powers. Not exactly her choice, the Amazons on Paradise Island decide to move on to a new dimension, in favor of a plainclothes identity as Diana Prince, a humanitarian adventurer in leather pants with a mean karate chop and an inscrutable Asian mentor. While this incarnation made Wonder Woman more hip and contemporary, it riled author Gloria Steinem, who felt that the reboot denied women, young and old, their one superpowered female role model. Steinem even put the Golden Age personae of Wonder Woman on the cover of her debut issue of Ms. Magazine in 1972. Either Miss Steinem or poor sales forced DC to turn the Amazon princess back to her roots by 1973. Still, Wonder Woman's zigzagging metamorphoses proved that reboots could provide a vital shot in the arm to the right kind of character. Mid-range superheroes, such as Marvel Comics' Captain Marvel and DC's Green Arrow, became more interesting after being rebooted in the 1970s, and the spectacular success of the new X-Men in 1975 certainly proved the salubrious effect of a reboot. Comic book fans mourned the eradication of a beloved figure, such as the Flash in Crisis on Infinite Earths, but the reboot of his character in the form of his sidekick Kid Flash, now mature enough to assume his mantle, made for some compelling and complex storylines, and Barry Allen returned in Geoff Johns' Flashpoint epic in 2011. Retcons are, among more loyal fans at any rate, far more controversial, because they essentially tinker with, or destroy, depending on your point of view, accepted and comforting narratives. Some critics and historians point to editor Roy Thomas as the first consistent retconner. Thomas's love for the heroes of the 1940s jump-started the nostalgia craze in the late 1960s when he added Golden Age characters to the Avengers. He also resuscitated two World War II-era superteams in the 1970s. For Marvel, the All-Winners Squad became the Invaders, and for DC, the All-Star Squadron took over for the Justice Society of America. At DC, the reverberations of Crisis were still being felt, a generation or two later. In the Superman universe, a 1986 retcon made Kal-El the sole survivor of Krypton's explosion, eliminating Supergirl, and had him assume his powers as an adult, eliminating Superboy. His adoptive parents, the Kents, were kept on as aging subsidiary characters, which didn't eliminate them at all. Mucking about with parents is a key device in retcons. In the Batman titles, Bruce Wayne was retconned to be younger, 9 years old, when his parents were killed, and their murderer, once given the name Joe Chill and previously captured by the Caped Crusader, was now an elusive and mysterious figure. In Wonder Woman's retcon, her mother, Queen Hippolyta, was featured more prominently. Her adventures during World War II were completely redacted, and she was returned more intently to her martial roots in Greek mythology. Even Paradise Island was rechristened, if that's the word for a pre-Christian culture, as Themyscira. In historical reality, it was a town, not an island. The nature of retcons at Marvel Comics are a bit more complicated. Even though the Marvel Universe is 2 decades younger than the DC Comics universe, much of that mythology was more complex to begin with. The plethora of X-Men characters, so expansive and diverse in any event, especially after they started to have multiple adventures in outer space in the 1980s, have led to legions of esoteric retcons too encyclopedic to mention. In fact, there are encyclopedias that could rival Burke's Peerage, which spell the whole thing out. The retcon wave engulfed poor Spider-Man in 2007 after he revealed his identity in Civil War. Marvel editor-in-chief Joe Quesada wanted Spider-Man to return to his bachelorhood, so a storyline entitled One More Day was created, where in order to save his Aunt May from death, Spider-Man and Mary Jane make a deal with the devil, Mephisto in this case, to eradicate their marriage in exchange for Aunt May's life. Boom. Done. Along with this very controversial decision to wipe out any existence of Spider-Man's happily married state, the world also no longer knows his secret identity. Another retcon, a few years later, postulated the unhappy proposition that in the early 1970s, Spider-Man's beloved Gwen Stacy had actually been impregnated by the Green Goblin and bore twin children a year before she was tragically murdered by the Fiend. Many fans felt this added insult to injury. As befits the granddaddy of all retcon characters, Captain America has had his share of revised continuity, although in his case, the revisions have deepened the resonance of his legend. When he reappeared in 1964, Stan Lee simply pretended that Cap's brief 1950s entanglements with communists didn't exist, and that he had been in an icy state of suspended animation since the closing days of World War II. A nifty retcon from the 1970s conjectured that during the Cold War, the missing Cap had been replaced by a B-level Timely Comics hero called the Spirit of 76, thus allowing both storylines to coexist. Even more impressive, however, was the 2004 7-part miniseries called Truth, Red, White, and Black. In this controversial saga, writer Robert Morales teamed up with artist Kyle Baker to peel back the layers that hid the secret history behind the Super Soldier Serum. They went back and merged two unfortunate chapters of American history. The infamous Tuskegee experiments, begun in the 1930s, in which 400 black men with syphilis were unwittingly subjected to the various trial remedies by the U.S. Public Health Service without their knowledge or consent, and the segregation of black soldiers in the U.S. Armed Forces. Truth spun a story set in 1940 based on a simple but provocative premise. As author Gary Phillips articulates it, Steve Rogers got the Super Soldier Serum injection and became Captain America. Well, what if, in fact, there had been some experimentation going on after that to perfect the formula? And rather than experiment on white soldiers, what if the government said, listen, we got these black soldiers here, why not experiment on them? And therein lies the truth. A regiment of chemically enhanced black soldiers storms Hitler's fortress and liberates a concentration camp. But the formula is too unstable, and one black renegade, Isaiah Bradley, who calls himself Captain America, is captured and disabled by the experience. As a bookend to the series, the Steve Rogers Captain America investigates the history of the regiment in 2004 and meets with his African-American successor, who is now reduced to an infantilized and infirm shadow of his former self, and honors Bradley's service to his country. Although the series met with some initial outcry from various chat rooms claiming the historical background was invented, it wasn't, and Morales backs up his facts with impressive source material, the Isaiah Bradley legend has now become an official part of the Captain America continuity. Bradley's grandson would even take on the mantle of another World War II superhero called the Patriot and fight evil into the 21st century. Of course, in addition to the inside baseball of clever retconning, there is also the simple evolution of characters. Superman and Lois Lane got married in 1996. Batman has taken several subsequent junior varsity Robins under his wing. One, Jason Todd, was murdered by the Joker. Another is actually Bruce Wayne's own son, Damian. Captain America's World War II sidekick, Bucky Barnes, emerged from the dead. Apparently, he had actually survived the war, but as a secret Soviet agent called the Winter Soldier, and was groomed to assassinate Captain America. But these alterations and evolutions beg one essential question. Why not leave well enough alone? It was a question asked of current writer superstar Mark Miller some years ago. I had a real moment when I was talking to Stan Lee one time. He said to me, "Why aren't you playing with your own toys? Why do you have to play with my old ones?" And he didn't mean it in a mean way. You see, my ambition when I was a kid was to come in and write these characters that I loved growing up. But to keep the pop culture alive, you have to be constantly creating new stuff. Based on the evidence, it does seem harder to create new stuff in comics and easier to go back to the classic heroes, all of whom are more than 5 decades old. Some of that, no doubt, stems from writers and artists such as Miller, who are enamored with the heroes of their childhood. Some of the apprehension toward new characters also comes from creators who are gun-shy at inventing new, potentially lucrative superheroes because they are concerned that the publishers will own the characters outright. And there is a certain sense that in the 1940s and 60s, the original creators got it right the first time. DC editor-in-chief and writer Geoff Johns puts it this way.
There are breakout characters that happen. It's harder to do because there are so many characters and wonderful characters out there. If I'm going to create a vigilante who wants justice and revenge and he's going to build the tech to do it, well, good luck beating Batman, right? Like, you look at Hawkeye and Green Arrow, right? Make another Archer that's going to beat those two characters. It's going to be very difficult to do it.
Both of the major publishers have recently come up with strategies that allow them to straddle both the world of traditional heroic narratives as well as variations on a theme. Marvel initiated the Ultimate Universe, exactly the kind of parallel universe that DC did away with in Crisis on Infinite Earths, but one that allowed Marvel to fast-forward some of their characters' backgrounds so they didn't seem like yellowed remnants of the 60s generation. In the Ultimate Spider-Man series, for example, Peter Parker was bitten by a genetically enhanced spider instead of a radioactive one. Furthermore, in a 2012 development in the Ultimate Universe, Peter Parker himself dies to be replaced as Spider-Man by a half-Hispanic, half-black teenager named Miles Morales. No worries, though. Peter Parker still swings away in the regular Marvel Universe. In a major house cleaning, DC Comics swept through all of their titles in 2012 and rebooted them extensively as the New 52, where, for example, Superman has never been married to Lois Lane, and Batgirl is allowed to stalk the night again for the first time in a quarter century, never having been shot and crippled by the Joker. As if to demonstrate the cutting-edge innovation of the New 52, all of the DC titles were released digitally on the same day. Jim Lee, DC's co-editor, confirmed that there were many good reasons for such an extensive overhaul.
When you're dealing with characters that have been around for 70-plus years, there are certain barnacles that sort of accumulate on the sides of the continuity ship. Continuity is the sort of the sum total of a character's history. And so over 75 years, imagine that there are a ton of things you have to remember to know truly who this character is. And sometimes, I mean, that's something that's very appealing to longtime fans, but it's also very off-putting to people that are trying to get into comics for the first time, people that don't have as much time to sort of devote to comic book collecting. And by resetting the numbers at number one, it appealed to collectors. It opened the door for a lot of people that were scared to kind of come in and experience the DC Universe. It gave them the opportunity to come in at the ground floor and understand who these characters are. And it also gave us a great opportunity editorially to look at all these characters and realize, hey, we have the opportunity now to strip away all the stupid stuff about the characters, keep the stuff that's really cool, and really redefine who these characters are. What makes Batman special? What makes Wonder Woman different from any other, you know, female hero in any universe? And so we kind of systematically went through the entire universe and picked sort of a creator top line. What makes this character, what motivates this character, what makes this character tick?
Heroes we have known and loved. Super Soldier, Man of War. First appearance, April 1996, Marvel Comics vs. DC, number 3. For decades, comic book fans had jockeyed around the ultimate fantasy. What would happen if the Marvel heroes took on the DC heroes? In 1976, that question was finally answered, for an isolated moment at least, in the tabloid-sized one-shot crossover book Superman vs. the Amazing Spider-Man, The Battle of the Century. Apparently, in 1975, Stan Lee had been looking for a literary agent and had lunch with David Obst, the agent who represented Woodward and Bernstein. Obst queried why Superman had never fought Spider-Man, and Lee countered that the legal and contractual obstacles between DC and Marvel were simply too overwhelming. Obst took the assignment upon himself as a mission. It helped that Lee and Carmine Infantino, DC's publisher, were friendly competitors. In fact, Infantino did the cover layout. The success of that unconventional covenant led to a few further crossover team-ups in the 1980s and early 90s, such as Batman and the Hulk, the X-Men and the Teen Titans, and so on. In 1996, DC and Marvel decided to go all in and create a megawatt miniseries called Marvel Comics vs. DC, or vice versa, depending which issue one bought, where the greatest stars of each company battled it out against one another. The sales from that series opened up a door to a more imaginative idea. A year later, the companies pooled their resources to create an entire lineup of hybrid heroes under the Amalgam Comics line, and a 12-issue series that replaced their own titles for a month. The newly minted heroes for Amalgam were just that, an amalgamation of two complementary heroes from both publishers. Some were pretty cool. The Flash and Ghost Rider combined to become Speed Demon. Some simply fessed up that one of the publisher's characters was a ripoff of the other. DC's 1940s resident magus Dr. Fate bonded with Marvel's 1960s mystic Dr. Strange to become, wait for it, Dr. Strange Fate. Box office champs Batman and Wolverine were combined to create Darkclaw, who appeared in a story about the son of a murdered millionaire who gets shipped off to Canada and gets superheroically enhanced. A reprise of the character was even drawn in the style of the Batman animated series on television. The cleverest hybrid of all was concocted by industry superstars Mark Waid and Dave Gibbons. Super Soldier. Set in the 1940s, Super Soldier's origin begins when U.S. government scientists isolate the genes of an extinct alien and inject them as a serum into puny Clark Kent. Kent is transformed into a red and blue costumed, shield-slinging warrior who works undercover for the Army. Along with his trusty sidekick, photographer Jimmy Olsen, Super Soldier sets sail for Europe, where he defends democracy against Hitler's hordes. The Amalgam Universe, which also created a battery of fictional company histories, archival material, and letters pages, might well have been impossible to sustain, but fans could feel the pure joy surging behind the effort, however brief. Alas, as the 21st century dawned, there were fewer and fewer DC Marvel crossovers or joint ventures. as each company was acquired by larger media conglomerates, relations between the industry leaders became frostier. Another balls-out venture, such as Amalgam, seems as unlikely as getting Democrats and Republicans to come together and amalgamate a federal budget. Animal Man. First appearance, September 1965, Strange Adventures number 180. You existed long before I wrote about you, and if you're lucky, you'll still be young when I'm old or dead. Not many superheroes can boast of being directly addressed by the writer of their adventures, but in 1990, Animal Man endured this unique fate. The author was Grant Morrison, who wrote himself in as a character in issue number 26, and what he said to his hero was essentially true. Animal Man first came into existence when Morrison was only 5 years old, in a seemingly one-shot tale in the science fiction omnibus, Strange Adventures, entitled I Was the Man with the Animal Powers. Buddy Baker was a stuntman who inherited an odd power while absorbing the radiation of a spaceship that crashed to Earth. He could absorb the power of any animal in his vicinity. He eventually got a superhero costume and pretty much languished in the dog pound of the DC Universe. When Morrison took the reins of a new Animal Man series in 1988, our hero was now married, slightly out of shape, and the slothful father of two kids in suburban San Diego. Eager to grab the lion's share of the superhero market, Animal Man tries to jumpstart his career, but discovers he is more attuned to the animal world and its dilemmas than he initially thought. During Morrison's 26-issue run of Animal Man, Buddy became a serious advocate of animal rights and vegetarianism, and the series veered into metaphysical territory, such as the much-lauded story where Animal Man encounters a potential messiah in the form of an indestructible coyote who strongly resembles a leading Looney Tunes character. Morrison inserted his own political, societal, and literary opinions as the series grew progressively more Pirandellian. Bidding farewell to his zoological hero, Morrison tells him, "Pointless violence and death is realistic. Comic books are realistic now. Maybe for once, we could try to be kind." Madman. First appearance, October 1990, Creatures of the Id. As the world of comic books got crazier in the 1990s, it was only a matter of time before the heroes did too. Perhaps no other superhero represents the anarchic world of independent comics and their highly original takes on the superhero genre than Michael Allred's stitched-together costumed adventurer, Madman. Originally a private investigator killed in a car accident, Madman was brought back to life by being sewn back together and reanimated by the eccentric scientist Dr. Boifard, whose brain would eventually grow to titanic proportions, but that's another story. Boifard dubbed his new creation Frank Einstein as a tribute to his favorite singer, Sinatra, and physicist, Albert. But any other illusion works just as well. Madman had a swell costume, modeled on his childhood hero, Mr. Excitement, which served to cover his patchwork body and some vague powers of agility and psychic prescience. He spent most of his time at Dark Horse Comics, where he had his own title for 6 years, running around in his naive and detached way with a cadre of mad scientists, drooling aliens, humorless robots, and torpedo-breasted women. If his Ed Wood-esque misadventures seemed as if they were made up as they went along, that was all part of the method behind Madman's madness. After all, any superhero who refers to his adversary mid-combat as "you stinky" can't be completely crazy. Invincible. First appearance, October 2002, Tech Jacket number 1. Not all independent comic book superheroes were creeps or creepy. Writer Robert Kirkman spun one of the 21st century's most appealing new heroes out of the fundamental tropes that kept Superman, Spider-Man, and even Superboy, fresh for decades. In a generic American town, young Mark Grayson, well, there's a throw to Robin the Boy Wonder too, goes through the typical high school grind, falling asleep in class, mooning over a pretty redhead, working after hours at a burger joint, only to discover one day that he has assumed a host of superpowers, including invulnerability and flight. It turns out that his seemingly middle-class father is actually Omni-Man, a supreme superhero from the Viltrumite race, and Mark has inherited much of his invincibility. Mark's coming of super age, his affection for his human mother, and his complex and ultimately antagonistic relationship with his omniscient dad was rendered in a fresh and uplifting way by artists Corey Walker and Ryan Ottley in more than 100 issues in the Image Comics imprint Skybound. Deadpool. First appearance, 1990, New Mutants, number 18. In many ways, Deadpool was a Frankenstein's monster, composed of the 1990s most popular superhero tropes, stitched together with the kind of, you can't possibly take this seriously, thread usually found on The Late Show with David Letterman. Yet another government-created assassin, Deadpool, created by Rob Liefeld and Fabian Nicieza, owed his actual roots to the mutant mojo of the X-Men. Seeking a cure for cancer, Wade Wilson, ostensibly Deadpool's real name, no one really knows, volunteered for a science experiment that involved being injected with an element of Wolverine's self-healing genes. Given the power of regenerating tissue, Deadpool was able to hang out his shingle as a much-desired mercenary. Covered head-to-toe with a red and blue suit, not unlike Spider-Man, to disguise the corrosive cancer taking over his body, Deadpool proved to be a more than capable combatant, wielding a pair of samurai swords that looked as if they had been boosted from the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. As if combining the characteristics of Wolverine, the Punisher, Spider-Man, and the Ninja Turtles weren't enough to ensure his popularity, Deadpool spoke in a near Asperger's stream of consciousness, a logorrhea of pop culture references and tough guy cliches. "Start spreading the news," he once crooned to a potential victim. "You're dying today because you tried to rip me off in old New York." Under the eventual guidance of writer Joe Kelly and artist Ed McGuinness, the Merc with a Mouth became one of Marvel's most peripatetic, if chattiest, superstars. And now, some villains we love to hate. Thanos. First appearance, February 1973, Iron Man, number 55. When writer-artist Jim Starlin first conceived of Marvel's baddest dude in the 1970s, he admittedly stole a page or two from Jack Kirby's Dark Side, but added a bit of Greek mythology, a concise bit. Thanos' name derived from a shorthand version of the Greek demon of death, Thanatos. Initially, Thanos was an interstellar interloper. Born out of the family of Titans, he was cast out by his mother in favor of his more attractive brother. He then wielded his considerable intellect, physical strength, and cosmic powers across the galaxy, committed to the service of up to no good. While other miscreants sought world domination, like Dr. Doom, or universal domination, like Darkseid, Thanos was a completely nihilistic narcissist, intent on destruction for its own sake. He tangled with another cosmic hero, Warlord, and facilitated the death of the Kree warrior, Captain Marvel. His main objective was to acquire the powerful Soul Gems, which, when collected into the Infinity Gauntlet, gave him abilities beyond imagining. In the 6-issue miniseries, The Infinity Gauntlet, he fell in love with death, literally, and offered her the lives of half the beings in the universe in much the same way a normal person would deliver a box of chocolates on Valentine's Day. The heroes of the Marvel Universe united against him. "Come and get me," Thanos taunted them, and they ultimately, if temporarily, prevailed. When the Mad Titan was revealed as the behind-the-scenes mastermind in a cameo after the final credits of the 2012 The Avengers film, fanboys across America shrieked in